Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dr. Morgan Simmons, Executive Officer of the National Register of Health Service Psychologists. Welcome to today's webinar. Before we get started, I'd like to welcome my co-moderator for today's presentation, Dr. Jana Martin. Dr. Martin is a CEO of the Trust, the nation's leading provider of professional liability insurance for psychologists. As most of you know, the Register and the Trust recently formed a partnership to deliver high-quality content to psychologists. Today's presentation is titled Record Keeping and Risk Management. Our featured presenter is Dr. Eric A. Harris, a licensed psychologist and attorney in Massachusetts and a member of the Trust's risk management team. Without further ado, I'm happy to turn it over to Dr. Martin.
Thank you, Morgan. I'm Jana Martin, CEO of the Trust. We are extremely pleased to partner with the National Register and look forward to combining our resources and expertise to positively impact Trust insureds, National Register members, and the wider community of psychologists. I'm very excited to introduce our featured speaker. Dr. Eric Harris is a licensed psychologist and attorney in Massachusetts. Dr. Harris has written, consulted, and lectured extensively on risk management, legal issues, managed care, and coaching. He has represented psychologists before both ethics committees and state licensing boards, and has been a consultant to both plaintiffs and defendants in mental health malpractice actions. Dr. Harris also recently retired as the legal counsel to the Massachusetts Psychological Association, where he also served as the Director of Professional Affairs for 10 years. Dr. Harris is also a member of our risk management team at the Trust. As many of you know, a significant benefit of being a Trust policyholder is access to free, confidential consultation from our risk management consultants. Dr. Harris is one of seven experts with clinical and extensive legal training who are on the Trust Risk Management team and provide guidance on a number of issues in addition to requests for records such as HIPAA compliance, informed consent, telepsychology, and difficult clinical issues. I know you will enjoy this presentation. Eric, turning it over to you.
Thanks, Jana. First part I have to say is that I do not have any conflicts of interest to disclose, at least none that I know of. So I want to take this opportunity to thank the National Register and the Trust for giving me this opportunity. What we're going to talk about today are record keeping and risk management. We have a limited amount of time to cover a lot of ground. So what we'll be doing is providing an overview of the area with as much detail as possible. And hopefully we will be able to briefly discuss a few examples at the end of the presentation, case examples, and we'll have some questions. So you can look, here is the learning objectives for the course. So all of you know that record keeping is a required activity of professional practice. It's mandated by law and regulation, APA ethics and standards, and judicial analysis. Most of you also know that there's very little specific guidance about the content of records. This has good and bad aspects. The good aspect is that it provides a diverse profession considerable discretion to keep that information that their particular situation requires. But the downside is that it's very hard to give specific guidance that many of you wish we would be able to provide to you. At the workshops I've given, I always am asked, why can't you give us a sample? And as often is the case, I demur, because it is very hard to give a sample record without giving a great deal of background about the specific facts and circumstances of the case. So what goes in the record depends on many factors. What your level of experience is and what your theoretical perspective is, what the risk level of the patient is or the situation, who's paying for services, is the patient paying, is a third party reimbursement source paying? Is it direct payment or indirect payment? Or is there some other arrangement? Are you working for an integrated care system, a hospital, or some other institution, college counseling center? What kind of practice type are you in? Is it a private practice or is it an institutional setting? And then there are the specific state laws and regulations of your particular jurisdiction. Every state has some regulations which describe, at least in overview, what information must be in the records and how long they must be kept and who has access to them. Records obviously should be adequate to accomplish all of the things on this slide. We're going to focus on the part that establishes the medical necessity and adequacy for insurance reimbursement purposes and how records can help you defend against accusations in the event of a complaint or audit. But before we go there, I'd like to just make a couple of comments. Record keeping has become, because of the pressure of money and various other kinds of issues, seen by many practitioners as an administrative or bureaucratic responsibility that is really not an essential part of providing really good treatment. However, in my judgment, the main reason for keeping good records is they will help you provide good, effective treatment and avoid the mistakes or the normal cognitive distortions which lead providers into difficult situations. Happy clients do not file complaints. So we're going to focus on managing the risk of licensing board discipline and malpractice, meet insurance audit requirements, and minimize the disclosure of potentially damaging patient information. First, a little about risk. Many people think that malpractice risk is the most significant risk that a psychologist faced. However, only 10% of psychologists will have a malpractice suit within a 20-year career. Most suits settle, and the settlement agreement will specifically deny any admission of guilt or responsibility. They will say, this is an amount paid in order to settle a dispute, and it does not admit to any of the allegations contained. In the long run, a suit, even if you lose it, will not damage your career in a significant way unless the amount of money that it's settled for is a very substantial amount. But it will have to be reported to the National Practitioner Data Bank. Will take a very long time. It will involve a lot of stress and distress, and it will make you feel like you have been through an enormous trauma over a number of periods of years, and obviously it's very hard to deal with that. However, the biggest risk to psychologists' careers are licensing board complaints. In a 20-year career, your chance of a licensing board complaint is 40%. Half those complaints will not survive the probable cause test of a particular licensing board. However, the 20% that do pose a real difficulty and risk to psychologists. The reason that disciplinary sanctions pose a greater potential risk to a damage to a career, particularly for those dependent on insurance reimbursement, is that in order for a board to impose discipline, there must be either an admission of or a finding that the psychologist violated the laws or ethics of a particular state licensing requirement. And that admission is a different kind of admission that you make in a settled lawsuit. In addition, the licensing board complaint is a public record and can often show up in this era of social media and online attacks and reviews in a very negative way. What are high-risk patients and situations? The ones which cause us the most, that generate the most complaints to us or the most consultation calls to the trust risk management program are clients with strong access to features. That does not mean that they have an access to diagnosis necessarily, but they do have features which at least would make you think that they may be have some access to features. Contested custody issues, both before and after the divorce. Suicidal patients. Serious breakdown in the therapist-patient relationship. When there is a breakdown in the therapist-patient relationship, the client usually is angry. And if that's combined with a client with access to features, they may feel very angry indeed and may feel the great need to actually punish the therapist for the way in which the therapist has not succeeded or has actually hurt them. There's also a correlation between breakdown in therapist-patient relationships and a crisis or loss in the therapist's personal life. That's particularly true in serious boundary crossing cases, where a good half the kinds of cases that we have dealt with involve a therapist who in one way or another had suffered a loss in either their intrapsychic or life situation. Third-party evaluations, particularly involving children, also present a risk because, again, parents have expectations and can often get very angry when they don't get what they need or think that they need involving their children. Obviously, significant negative or erotic transference is an indicator that one needs to be very careful and get good consultation and try to figure out whether or not the relationship can be saved. Multiple relation issues are also important. Many psychologists with good intentions see a couple and then see an individual member of the couple, or start seeing an individual and then take on a couple, or have a variety of other situations in which there's more than one potential client without the therapist recognizing that those two situations can actually be a conflict of interest. And then the most significant test is when the hair on the back of your neck stands up. Licensing boards present a great risk. It's important to remember a couple of things. Your license to practice is a privilege, not a right, which means that it can be more easily sanctioned or even taken away than something that you have a property right in. Your license to practice is based on your following the rules and you're being competent, you're having sufficient training to be a practitioner. The licensing board is a consumer protection agency, which creates a bias in favor of the complainant. The complaint process is primarily a prosecutorial one. That is, the job of the licensing board is to protect consumers against bad practice by psychologists. The board is usually housed either with the Attorney General or with the Consumer Protection Bureau, but the support, the investigators and the lawyers are in fact prosecutorial in the sense that their job is to pursue complaints and find the party that's responsible. That's not to say that these people are not fair-minded, but they start with a particular bias. So many people describe the process is that you're presumed to have done what the complainant says and have to show that, in fact, that isn't the case, where in the usual situation, it would be up to the complainant to show that that was the case. The other problem that you have with licensing boards is, unlike medical boards, psychology licensing boards usually have very little support staff. The members of the board are appointed by the governor, but they are not trained in legal issues or due process. They are volunteers, and therefore they are usually subject to guidance from the prosecutorial folks that are around their staff, their deliberations, and their experience. The other thing is that the laws and regulations regulations are very vague, and they give the board great prosecutorial discretion. If you look at your licensing board regulation, you will see a whole list of things which discipline can be opposed for, which are usually quite general, and a creative licensing board can find some fit regardless of what the complaint is. And they can and will expand the investigation beyond the initial complaint. Many people feel like the boards, in addition to doing discipline, are engaging in peer review in the guise of discipline. So if they can find something in your practice that they don't like, even though it wasn't something that was specifically complained about in the complaint, they can expand their review to include that. The process is front end loaded. That is, first of all, your primary task is to overcome hindsight bias. We've already talked about how the process creates a certain amount of anchoring in accepting the narrative of the complainant. And as Daniel Kahneman has so aptly shown, these kinds of distortions are built into this kind of a process. It's hard to overcome the initial investigation's conclusion. So the way it works is, the first part of the board process is primarily prosecutorial. What I mean by that is, the board is like a police department that is doing an initial investigation to see whether or not there has been a crime or a problem. At some point, the board will decide, having interviewed, having looked at the answers to complaints, your records, and sometimes an interview with the complainant and an interview with you, or sometimes they go forward without even having that experience. And at that point, if they have found something wrong, they will usually offer you a consent agreement. And many of these consent agreements, they consider to be educational. But the fact that these consent agreements, when you sign them, impose discipline, which acknowledges that you have somehow violated your professional responsibilities, means that there will be a consequence if you accept them. On the other hand, you don't have to accept them. You can also request a hearing, a due process hearing. But those are expensive and take a long time. And folks who have had a lot of experience representing psychologists often report that once the board has formed an opinion that you violated the rules, it's very, very hard to win on appeal. So in a situation like this, good records are the most crucial thing for an effective defense. Your job as a psychologist before a licensing board is to be able to demonstrate that you have a good knowledge of basic ethical principles and rules governing your professional practice, that you have the experience and knowledge about the type of therapy you are providing and the practice of psychology in general, that you know how to apply this knowledge to specific situations, particularly the situation you find yourself in that's led to the complaint, that you are a careful, respectful professional, and that you can recognize mistakes and learn from them. The only real way that you can do this is by having a good record, because no matter how clever and erudite you may be at fashioning a response to the complaint, if your records don't support your response, then the board is going to see your response as self-serving and not give it the credence that it deserves. However, and also, if you don't have good records, then you have a situation where you've already shown the board that you aren't practicing up to the appropriate standard of care, which requires good records, not perfect records, but good records. And that then creates pressure or at least provides evidence that the board should in fact side with the complainant, and the complainant's story is probably right. When you have a high-risk situation, when the hair on the back of your neck stands up, you should switch into ninth-grade algebra record-keeping mode. What you did and why you did it, what strategies you rejected and your reasons for rejecting those strategies, how you resolved conflicts between the potential benefits or particular potential risks of the various choices that were confronting you with regard to how to deal with the patient's issues, the ethical and legal principles which were involved in your decision-making, if there were any, and very importantly, consultations and the reasons that you rejected any recommendations made by consultants, if there are any. When you are facing a licensing board complaint, it is more important that you describe in detail why you didn't do what you didn't do than what you did do and why you did it. Because if what you did do and why you did it worked out, no one would be complaining. Now, record keeping is a business decision. How much time is spent in order to protect oneself? If you have a full caseload, there is no way that you can keep ninth grade algebra records for every client in your practice. In fact, knowing when to keep ninth grade algebra records and how to keep the level of high risk patients and situations in your practice at a manageable level is also a very crucial risk management tactic. Remember, if you didn't write it down, you didn't do it. And never, ever alter a record in an attempt to make yourself look better. Most of the time, if you try to alter the record, you won't get caught. But if you do get caught, you have now moved from being a psychologist who made a mistake to an individual who is character disordered. Let's talk a little bit about audit-ready records. So, audit-ready records, we're talking about this with regard to third-party payers, should start with initial evaluation, including the patient's description of the problems which brought him to therapy and the ways in which he believes or she believes that they negatively impact his health or her health, his or her functioning at work and home, and his or her relationships with others. I apologize for just using the male pronoun there. The patient's current stressors, coping strategies, social support systems, strengths and weaknesses, and risk factors. The patient's relevant medical and psychological history, and the patient's goals for treatment. All of this information should lead you to an appropriate DSM or ICDM diagnosis. Diagnosis is very important, and I've talked to many psychologists who do one of two strategies, both of which we don't recommend. One is they underdiagnose in order to protect the patient. Two is they overdiagnose in order to secure for the patient additional reimbursement from the insurance company, who is less likely to provide services with a less significant diagnosis. Both of those strategies are problematic and can result in a lot of trouble. And then you would want to have a treatment plan which includes the goals. And goals must be behavioral, measurable, and achievable. It's important to remember that when you are providing services and receiving third-party reimbursement for it, they are looking at you as a healthcare provider. And what they want to know is what problems the person has, how you're going to intervene in those problems, and how you're going to know whether your treatment has been successful or not. In behavioral terms, your session notes should be able to demonstrate to a knowledgeable observer that appropriate, competent psychotherapy occurred It must reflect knowledge of medical necessity, definitions, medical necessity definitions, and documentation guidelines of the payer and the managed care company. Should be legible, and the length and comprehensiveness will be determined by the length of treatment, the risks, and the likelihood of UR. It's important to say a little bit about how third-party payers decide who and what to audit. They're either a result of a complaint by someone about a particular psychologist, a computer algorithm that looks at your practice pattern versus the practice pattern of your colleagues, and if they find your one standard deviation, I'm making up the one standard deviation, but that you're some major variation between your practice and other people's practice, they are likely to want to look at why that is the case, and they're going to ask you to justify it. And the third way that they decide audits is by a particular targeted practice that they want to discourage. One of the ones which we saw a little bit in Massachusetts was the use of 90847 on a regular basis as opposed to 90834. They had data that showed that 90834 was essentially what most people used, and so folks that were using 90847 for many or most of their clients were required to explain why their client base required more treatment than the client base of their colleagues. Session notes, in order to do well in audits, must be specific. They need to be related to treatment goals. They should be expressed in terms of the changes in the patient's functioning. They must include a reasonable explanation for having made limited progress. They should be drafted with the understanding that they will be seen by others, including the patient. Let's talk a little bit about patient access rules post HIPAA. The major purpose of HIPAA was to protect the privacy of medical records and to put access to records under control of the patient. What HIPAA defines as the clinical record, which is very similar to the record-keeping content that we've discussed, can only be withheld from a patient upon appropriate request if there is a significant risk to life or physical safety. This is true of adult patients. Children have different standards. The access to children's records are determined by state law, because when the Bush administration put forth the HIPAA rule, they wanted to make sure that there was no interference with HIPAA and parental abortion notification laws. So it's very clear that a requirement is that if you are in a state that gives you the right to withhold children's records from parents and others for good clinical reason, that rule takes precedence over HIPAA. But the one other exception with adults is psychotherapy notes. Now, there is still a good deal of confusion about psychotherapy notes. This is partly because the language of the rule is unclear, and when broadly interpreted, it's in conflict with the HIPAA commentary that was released along with the rule. The rule is pretty broad, but the HIPAA commentary says that psychotherapy notes are notes that are only important to the therapist and are not necessary for others to be able to understand what went on in the treatment. So the rule does not provide as much privacy protection as many practitioners wish it did. This is a definition of psychotherapy notes which my colleague Jeff Youngman and I came up with. It is not officially anybody's, it's just what we recommend and have seen. Psychotherapy notes include my impressions and analysis of the process of therapy, what goes on in the therapy relationship. Sometimes these are just working hypotheses which help me to make sense of what you're telling me and which could interfere with the therapeutic process if they're revealed to you. It also includes intimate details which you provide to me that are not central to the therapy and would not be necessary for other professionals to understand your treatment. That's one definition, not the only one. The requirements for HIPAA psychotherapy notes is that they must be kept separately from the basic records. Separately means, in our judgment, a separate file and probably a separate file drawer. They are not a substitute for individual session notes. You cannot say psychotherapy 45 minutes and claim that the rest of your record is a psychotherapy notes. They cannot be released without a separate patient authorization, which means if there is a legitimate request for all of your records, such as by court subpoena or a court order, or with patient authorization, there has to be two, not one, specific authorizations. Psychologists are not legally or ethically required to keep psychotherapy notes. They are completely optional. Decision can vary from patient to patient and from session to session, depending on the facts and circumstances of the case. The best usage seems to be by psychodynamic therapists in self-pay situations with low-risk clients. Those are the least risky cases generally. But again, it's really important to remember that you still have to have the basic elements of the record that we talked about previously for third-party reimbursement. Many psychologists will elect to keep one set of records to minimize the complexity of their practice. Psychotherapy notes are only protected if state law provides discretion to withhold records to protect patients' emotional well-being. It used to be that most states had such laws, but HIPAA and the sort of general idea that patients need to know and have a right to know what's going on in their medical treatment are in the process of eliminating those, and the trend is definitely towards access. Even when this discretion is allowed, there are substantial exceptions which limit the utility of them. Withholding records with high-risk patients in high-risk situations often seriously damages the relationship. And most importantly, it increases the patient's determination to secure the records. And it will increase the negative impact if that determination is successful and will increase the possibility of complaints. What do I mean by that? If you have an access to client who wants to see your records and you tell them that you're not going to show them their records, your psychotherapy notes, because it's in their best interest not to see it, they will believe that you are hiding information from them that they absolutely need to see, because it must be negative. And so when they actually get the record, that's what they'll be scanning for, the negative. And so if you had just given them the record in the first place, there may have been some issues created between you and the client, but they would be the kind of issues which you ought to be able to settle in the normal course of treatment. Whereas if you withhold the records, then you're going to have to deal with why did you withhold them. The other thing is that the HIPAA has the minimum necessary rule, which provides a method of limiting information in response to overbroad requests. What the HIPAA minimum necessary rule says is that the provider determines what information is necessary to satisfy the purpose for which the request is made. And you are therefore given the option of only providing that information. So you can redact the parts of your record which do not are not necessary for that purpose. And if you are using electronic records, this does not create a tremendous barrier. You can, and after a while, I think you begin to keep records so that the parts that you know you're going to have to release are easily separable from the parts that you don't think are going to be releasable. So let's take a few minutes to talk about some high-risk case examples, and then we'll turn to the questions. So the first one is you've got an adolescent 16-year-old girl who's experimenting with boys, soft drugs, and other risky behaviors, including sexual experimentation. Her parents have had a contentious divorce 3 years earlier, and they now have joint custody. However, the anger that remains from the divorce and the custody battle means that they can barely agree on anything, including what they need to know from the therapist. In this situation, the most important part of your record is the informed consent discussion that you have with the parents about what information you are free to withhold and what information they insist on having. And that requires a discussion of risk. One of the things we know about adolescents is that if they're not experimenting with risky behaviors, they probably have a problem. But what different people consider to be sufficiently risky to require that the therapist disclose to them, and what the kid considers sufficiently risky to have to disclose to them, are often very different. So there needs to be a good discussion with both parents, if they have joint custody, about what is and isn't going to be disclosed, and what the consequences are if the disclosure needle is set too high. Because one of the things you can say is, if you want me to tell you everything your 16-year-old girl is telling me, then I can tell you that you might as well not engage in therapy, save your money for a trip to Disneyland. Second case. A long-term client who develops an intense transference, particularly erotic, toward the therapist, which leads to dangerous demands on the therapist. The minute you begin to feel that there is a transference that is more intense than is warranted by the circumstance, you need to immediately seek consultation. And you need to note in your record that you are seeking consultation and that you are aware of it. And you need to have a discussion of what the factors are which indicate that the relationship can be worked through and you can move forward, or what are the indications that you would need to terminate the treatment because continuing forward is likely to intensify the risk to the patient. As you go forward, if you decide to continue, you will need to note pretty clearly the pros and cons of what you're doing. And you will need to consult pretty much on a regular basis, and again, those consultations. If you decide that you are going to terminate their patient, you need to have a discussion of what the consequences will be of various forms of termination. How long do you give? Do you do it immediately because the situation is such that even having 5 or 6 more sessions or 2 months worth of sessions will just make things worse? Or do you basically do the normal kind of termination of the relationship, which really gives you and the client a chance to discuss how you got to where you've gotten and why it's necessary to end, and what the client has already been able to gain from the work you've done together. The final case example, and I know I'm going over these with just skimming over, but an adult client with a number of suicidal gestures rehearsals was being treated by a psychiatrist, but frequently is resistant to regular medication schedule and is adamantly resistant to inpatient treatment. There is no possibility of involuntary commitment under state law. This is a call that we get very, very frequently because the concern of the therapist is, what happens if the patient commits suicide? Is the family going to sue me? What am I going to feel like in that experience? And that kind of anxiety is significant and can often lead to bad decisions being made by the therapist. Again, consultation is the most important part of this. But also, if this is a situation in which ninth grade algebra records are really important, because there are no right decisions that you can make in this case. If you choose to continue to work with the patient, you have to be able to justify why you're doing that. But you also have to talk about whether or not, if you decide to terminate or transfer the case, will this actually increase the possibility of suicide? Are there collaterals? Is the patient married? Does he have a parent? Can you be in consultation with him? Maybe that's a condition of your continuing to work with that patient. All of these things need to be recorded in detail, not only the ones that you choose to do, but the things that you reject, as we've said previously. That brings us to the 15-minute question and answer period. So I'm now going to turn it over to Morgan to ask me some questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Harris. As promised, we'll be using this portion of our time together to present a few questions submitted by our audience. And I must say, we have a very large number of questions. I apologize in advance if I'm unable to get to all of them, which we won't be able to. But I will ask Dr. Harris to respond to some of the more commonly asked questions in as succinct a way as possible so we can try and get as many answers as possible in our limited time together. Here's an interesting one that came up, Eric. I know that state law dictates, individual jurisdictions dictate custody of records upon the retirement of a psychologist. But we've got a couple of questions about, is there a general rule for keeping records once the psychologist has retired? And a very interesting twist on that, the psychologist is planning on retiring overseas. Should the records remain with the psychologist or should they be housed in the States?
Well, the first part of the question is that you are required, even when you retire, to keep records for the time that you were required to keep records if you were still in practice. So that varies from state to state. APA standards, which apply in states that don't have their own record, are that you have to keep them for 7 years or till the client's 21st birthday, whichever is longer. California has it's 7 years from the last date of service, and then 7 years past the client's, I can't remember whether it was 18th or 21st birthday, but that's a very long period of time. The question of how do you manage keeping records when you retire, when you're going off to Bora Bora or New Zealand or any one of a number of places, is one that we get frequently. There are several ways to do it. You certainly can take the records with you, particularly if you have electronic records. That doesn't provide a big problem. It's always important with all electronic records to remember that you need to have them contained in an encrypted place so that should you lose the computer, that you would not lose the records, and that you also should have a backup established, and the backup should be kept according to HIPAA in a different place than the actual electronic record is kept. One of the ways that we've suggested that's creative is that you can create a website, which is created for the sole purpose of allowing someone to contact you if they need a copy of your record. It's one of the real advantages of the internet, because you're almost certainly not going to go someplace, even overseas, where internet service is not available. The person can get in touch with you by either clicking on the website, or you can create an email address specifically for that purpose. It's a bigger problem if you have paper records. And in that situation, you may need to appoint a colleague or someone who you have a business associate contract with under HIPAA that will be available to forward the records from wherever they're kept in storage, even though you're not able to do it yourself.
All right. Thank you very much. And in a similar...
Oh, by the way, one more thing. You should always notify a licensing board of where you can be reached, even if you're giving up your license. because the first place people will look for is the licensing board. And if you've left them with an address, that makes it much easier.
Yeah, that's good advice. On a similar note, as we move into the brave new world of the electronic health record, we've had a number of questions that have to do with various aspects of record keeping in the EHR. Let me just give you a couple of the examples that have been brought up by the audience, and you can respond to those as you see fit. What about storing psychotherapy notes? Should they ever be contained in an electronic health record? Another one, another question was, what about storing raw test data? Should that be ever entered into an EHR, or should those records be kept separately?
Okay, well, so that's a question which depends on where you're working and what the purpose of your job is. Most of these questions that I hear involve working in some kind of integrated medical setting, which has a common EHR. The first important question is, in one of those systems, it's very important for you to find out who has access to your records. Is access determined on a need-to-know basis, or is access available to anyone, and any inappropriate accessing of records is dealt with by post-audit efforts? If there is a really good need-to-know system, then you can put all of your records in the same place. If you work in a medical setting, most of them will not allow you to keep psychotherapy notes. So one of the things that psychologists frequently have to negotiate when they are in a medical setting is whether or not the medical setting will allow them to keep notes outside of the electronic healthcare records. And the reason that a medical setting will not want you to do that is because it makes them, first of all, they may think that there's information that's essential. The whole idea of an integrated medical setting is information is available to all of the people that treat the patient. That's part of the idea of an integrated medical setting. Secondly, there is a real risk management exposure for them if there are secret records which they don't know about and something happens to the client, which can then be directed towards, well, if we had known what was in the psychotherapy note, we wouldn't have, we would have provided different treatment. So you have to ask the, you have to negotiate with the medical setting that you're in. But by and large, when you're in a medical setting, most people in medical settings don't really look to keep psychotherapy notes, with the one exception of testing. And with testing, you have to also, this is a very complicated thing, so I'm not going to be able to cover it completely, but raw data can't be kept in test data cannot be kept in psychotherapy notes. That's part of HIPAA. So the only thing that you're allowed to protect is the actual protocols. And in my judgment, the best way to do that is to use the minimum necessary rule and cite the policy of the testing publisher when someone requests the actual protocols. Now, sometimes a judge will order the protocols released, and that really requires you to make a call to the Trust Risk Management Program.
So in general, if I understand you correctly, if you are petitioned to release raw test data, particularly mm-hmm. in EHR, the assumption, although challengeable, is that you are probably going to have to release those data. Is that correct?
Yes. And usually the way it works out, though, is you basically say, well, I'm going to have to separate the data from the protocols, and there's going to be no way that a non-psychologist can understand, it'll be like gobbledygook. What you should really do if you want to see the whole thing is give me the name of a psychologist, which I can send it to, and I will. And if you give me their name and their address, I can send the whole record there.
I understand. We've had a number of questions come in about working with children. And as you noted, there are some high-risk situations associated with custody and other child issues. And you pointed out that parental anger regarding disappointment over the results of an evaluation of a child can also be an independent risk factor. So can you very briefly describe for us some additional considerations for documentation when working with minors, and how might you reduce the risk of involvement, of becoming involved in a custody battle? Should you use specific language in an informed consent or?
Yes, in fact, if you go to, and I'm without going into the specific language, if you go to trustinsurance.com under resources, you will see a an informed consent document that we've created to help providers discuss with the parents of children what the rules are about access and structure discussion between the parents and the therapist about what is and isn't stuff that should be disclosed and how they're going to work that out. The problem, the other thing that is very important when you're involved with, and this is also contained in the document that we have on our website, is to make it clear to them that you under no circumstances are going to take sides in the dispute between the two parents.
Okay.
That you cannot, no matter what, you hope that they won't call you as a witness in a divorce or custody case, but even if they do call you as a, in a divorce or custody case, you will not be able to give any opinion on custody, visitation, or parenting capacity, because to do so would violate your ethics because you haven't done an evaluation that would be essential in order for you to form that conclusion. And if they want that kind of input, they'll have to get either a guardian ad litem or a custody evaluator who's a mental health professional who would be able to do such an evaluation.
That sounds reasonable. I'm sorry, we've had so many great questions and we're not going to be able to make it through all of them. I do have one final question. I think I know the answer to this, but I'm willing to be educated by you. If you are faced with a licensing board complaint, should you ever meet with an investigator without an attorney present, even if you were to meet on an informal basis with that investigator?
There is no such thing as an informal interview. It would be the same thing as having a police interview you about a crime without having a lawyer present. These people are not on your side. They understand that almost everyone lawyers up. And the only way that I would meet with someone who is an investigator informally is after I have consulted with a lawyer who is knowledgeable about the licensing board process in the particular state, and that is their advice, and there's a reason why they would do that. There are some circumstances where the complaint is so obviously distorted and the result of emotional problems that a lawyer may advise you to meet without them. But I have represented psychologists. I used to do that before I went for the trust. I used to represent psychologists before the board. And never in my experience did I advise a psychologist to meet with an investigator without a lawyer. Sometimes the lawyers don't come with you. Sometimes they just prep you.
Well, I'm sorry, but we don't have any more time. This does conclude our Q&A session. Thank you, everyone, for attending today's webinar. Thank you all very much for attending. Thank you, Dr. Harris, for a very informative presentation. Have a good day.